Good morning. Finally, some nice weather for us to frolic in. So this morning, I want to talk about difficulty as opportunity. And, yes? Oh, sure. This morning, I want to talk about difficulty as opportunity. I think the people who have been had one-to-ones with me over the years get tired of hearing me say that every time they bring a difficulty to me. I say, oh, there's an opportunity. So I thought I would just give a whole talk on it today. And then maybe, I don't know what would happen, but since I'm saying it all the time, I thought I'd give a talk on it. So difficulty is opportunity. Well, life is the way it is, means that we can't stay in our comfort zone and open up to big heart, open up our hearts, and open up to big mind. If we stay within our comfort zone, we're just clinging to our little fear body, our little fear body self, little Tim. And difficulty gives us a chance to open up. Even though when we have a difficulty, we experience discomfort. I mean, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? That's probably a part of a definition of difficulty, is discomfort. But staying in our comfort zone is because we're afraid. And it's actually not very comfortable to contract, to get rigid, to develop this crust around our heart. It's not very comfortable. And when we say to ourselves, well, this isn't a good time, this isn't the right opportunity for me to do such and such, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. Maybe it's the fear talking. And maybe to really live an authentic life, whatever that is, we need to take on new challenges that stretch us in directions that we didn't necessarily anticipate, so that we can live beyond the confines of this little guy in here who's always struggling, worried, and building, protecting himself, and trying to be okay. So that we can do what Walt Whitman said: "I am vast. I contain multitudes." And what my teacher called big mind or big heart mind. We are vast. We contain multitudes. So we can transform our fear into some enthusiasm to engage with whatever comes up. And of course, difficulty means negative emotion. Sorry. Difficulty means negative emotion. But are negative emotions stuff we should just throw out and get rid of? What's the upside of feeling down? What's the upside? I have this written in my notes. What's the upside of feeling down? Afflictive emotions, we call them in Buddhism. They afflict us, right? They afflict us. Anger, sadness, fear, we're afflicted by them. But they're giving us a message that we need to change what we're doing. And so they're necessary for feeling good in a way. There's an upside to having them because they're a clue. They're a teaching. Wrath, envy, jealousy, fear, guilt, in the Judaic Christian tradition, sins, right? In polite interaction in Japanese Zen culture, too polite to talk about. Too impolite to talk about. And so there's research on the results for Japanese men of their acculturation to politeness and inability to talk about negative emotions. They research shows that, now I don't know, this research was like 20 years ago, so things may have changed. Research shows that Japanese men tend to somatize their emotions. That means they take them into their body and they experience them in a negative way in their body. And they've related this to cancer in Japanese men and other kinds of. So we've got the Judeo-Christian culture, we've got the Japanese Zen culture. Well, American culture. Well, American culture is a little bit, I think, more accepting of negative emotion. Not so much Scandinavian Minnesota. Not so much. You know, it's grin and bear it, but it's grin with your teeth clenched, right? But if we suppress them, if we medicate them, and if we berate ourselves for feeling them, what happens? What happens? We get all clogged up, and our little Tim gets encrusted. There's a crust that develops around little Tim, a crust that he thinks protects him, but really just closes down his ability to enjoy being, to appreciate being. And these negative emotions, so-called negative emotions, afflictive emotions, are not inherently positive or negative. In a way, if we work with them, if we acknowledge them, they help us achieve what we want to achieve. They help us manifest what we want to in our hearts. So they're crucial to existence and to feeling good. So we have the possibility to engage the full range, just like the full scale of the piano keys, including the keys at both ends of the spectrum. And we also know that these negative emotions can help us at key times, that anxiety actually can boost performance. It does boost performance if we don't overdo it. If we experience it early and it motivates us to get ready. So I don't feel anxious when I'm getting ready to give talks anymore. But I used to. Maybe my talks were better then. I would prepare them like a month ahead then. Now I prepare them 8 minutes ahead. But anxiety helps us focus if we don't overdo it. So to say we want to get rid of it, it's, well, you can say that, but good luck. Good luck. I've been doing Zazen for a while, you guys. Good luck. Anger, embarrassment, shame, guilt, jealousy, envy, in a way, they're like hunger and thirst. They're part of our psyche. They're just part of our psyche, and they're key to survival. They communicate to us important stuff. Maybe the situation that we're in needs to be rectified. They give us feedback. So, example I'll give right now is anger. Anger. Anger can mobilize energy. It can focus attention. It can help us perceive a wrong. Perceive a wrong and right a wrong. The example that I have used here over the years about myself, anger. So my brother hung himself in a locked ward of a psych hospital when he was 30 and I was 40. And I was here in this neighborhood at the time. I've been here a long time. And I was angry. I was angry. I was angry at myself. I was really angry that he got locked up. I wasn't so angry at him. I was angry at the system and the fact that he was suffering with his depression and that they locked him up at all. That anger stayed with me. It stayed with me. But I was able to work with that anger, and as a result, I worked for like, I don't know how many years, maybe 5 or 6 years to open a crisis residence here in Minneapolis for people who were in mental health crisis, Nancy Page Crisis Residence. And it took me 6 years, and I was angry the whole time. So you think your anger is going to go away from doing Zazen? Well, it might go away for 40 minutes until the bell rang, you know. You go back out in the world. That's great. It's good to get that break. But if you think it's going to go away permanently, you got to practice some other kind of religion. But that religion is a fake religion, I'll tell you. Because we're humans. We're humans. So I was able to, if I hadn't been angry, there'd be no crisis residence. Well, there might be somebody else. Somebody else's brother probably. Her sister committed suicide in a locked ward, and they would have created one. But I really worked hard. It was my whole life, aside from coming here. So we need to be kind to the broken places inside ourselves. We need to be kind to the broken places. Instead of wallowing, slowly move back into the flow. Slowly I tried to move back into the flow after my brother's suicide. Change takes a long time. It takes a long time. But we can do it. And our emotions help us. They're guideposts. Especially if we're not obsessive about them, but really channel them. They're guideposts. And our meditation can help us learn how to just be with them and not be fixated on them, not be overwhelmed by them, but channel the energy. There's a lot of energy in those emotions that we can channel to help all beings, including ourselves. Difficulty and failure. Failure is like this difficulty just is impossible. I can't do it. With a big failure, everything stops. No movement to flow into. But there's a current there anyway, even though everything was stopped for me then. A current was there. Maybe it's an undercurrent pulling us deeper than we want to get pulled. I didn't want to come sit here every morning and just be facing a wall and be pulled deeply into that sense of, oh, my anger, my sadness, my hurtness. But I did it. It's because I wanted to live. I wanted to live. I wanted to do turtle practice. When a turtle rests, it draws its legs in, it draws its tail in, it draws its head in, it draws in its senses, sense of sight, sense of sound, sense of smell, sense of touch. And then as thoughts arise, attached to the emotion, we just let them pass through until we settle into something really still, really still. Taking time every day to do your turtle zazen, your turtle meditation. Taking every day to do my turtle meditation, even when I was feeling all this stuff. I began to see my feelings with some radiance and some clarity. Right in the middle of the anger, some radiance radiating out. Feeling connected, my heart feeling connected to other people who are suffering. And clarity, because I didn't have to chatter on and on about the feeling. If you let the feeling be as it is, you don't have to chatter on and on about it. You can just draw on its energy and its life. It's right there. When we stay with our meditation practice, regardless of what's happening, praise or blame, success or failure, whatever it is, pleasure, despair. Three kinds of shifts happen. Three kinds of shifts. One, we shift from what do I want to get from my meditation practice to what can I learn about myself. We begin to see our fear-based thinking, our judgments, and how they drive our destructive behaviors. And we learn to meet life rather than run away within our little encrusted Tim fear body. And the fruits of changing from the question, what do I want to get from my meditation, to what can I learn about myself and the world, are openness and resilience. So what I learned from about myself, among other things, from my anger about my brother's suicide, was that, and I'd already been teaching here for a long time. I started practicing when I was very young. So when I was 40, I'd been a priest here for 5 years, and I was giving Dharma talks. But what I learned was that I was telling everybody all, and I was telling myself kind of, oh, you can just let these emotions drop away and not be plagued by them. I learned that that's not true. That it doesn't matter how enlightened you become. The emotion comes back. The pain that we have, the hurts that we have, the wounds that we have, they're really deep. They come back. They don't leave. They're actually in our bodies. So I learned that, and I learned that in a wonderful way that I could then begin to value them, begin to be compassionate toward them, but not think that I had transcended them. When you want to transcend something, you're not really being alive in the world as it is. You're caught by your idea of transcending. Or then I transcended. I'm the Roshi around here. I've been practicing now for 52 years. I'm transcended. That's the little body that wants to transcend and have some power. Yeah, it's the poor little guy. He wants to transcend, so give him a popsicle. It's summer. He give him a popsicle, a nice cool popsicle. Second shift. From what can I learn about myself to what can I discover about my relationships with others? Turning away, just gradually, not doing this organically, not just gradually, not trying to turn it into a religion. Turning away from self-centered thought. The fruits are empathy and compassion. The fruits are empathy and compassion. Gradually we open up. We open up the encrusted heart and we feel empathy and compassion because we're not focusing just on what can I learn about myself, but what can I discover about my relationships with you guys and my family and the homeless people and all that stuff. And so that was very important to me. That anger helped me because I and my brother's death helped me. It helped me. It helped me be more empathic with people who have chemical issues and mental health issues. And my brother had both mental illness and chemical dependency, and he masked his symptoms. He masked them. Think about your own self or people you know who've had chemical dependency. Are they just masking some real pain underneath? Some real anxiety, some deep depression, some hopelessness? And see, when I was out in California and my brother would drink, I just get really pissed, you know, interfering with us. And I didn't tap into the real hopelessness that he was feeling. About everything. Hopelessness. So, what can I learn about myself to what can I discover about my relationship with others? I discovered that all those people in my family who drank all that stuff, that a lot of them were really hurting inside. Really hurting. And just to treat the chemicals without acknowledging and helping them with the hurt, it's not so cool. Not so cool. Not very compassionate. Not very compassionate. And of course, in those days, probably still now, chemical dependency had less stigma than mental illness. So, you know, you could be chemically dependent, and especially if the guys I hung out with, you could talk about that, but mental illness was a sign of weakness. Just cultural stuff that we make up. We just made all that stuff up. And we end up being plagued by it and plaguing others. So anyway, that's the second change. The third change is that we have the possibility to wake up to a reality without boundaries, recognizing that we're all in this together. We're all in this together. Beginning to experience the world as it is. And the fruits of that is a deep calmness inside. I don't know where it comes from. And a confidence that comes from that calmness. Right in the middle of the emotion. Right at the center of the hurricane. That's where the stillness is. So, in my own case, because of this anger that I carried around with me, except when I was doing Zazen, when my Zazen was good, right? Good Zazen. Be careful of good Zazen, and you want to have good Zazen. Then when the bad feelings come in, you think, oh, this is bad Zazen. Really? Really? Are you sure? Are you sure? Tell me about it. I want to learn about this difference between good and bad Zazen. If you open up your heart, you just completely open up your heart all the way. Is there any difference? Is there any difference at all? I don't think so. So, because of this anger, then I started doing really weird things, like thinking I could go to the legislature and talk to legislators about developing crisis residents here in Minneapolis for people with mental health problems. And I had never been at the legislature. I didn't know anything about lobbying. I just started, and of course my job allowed me to do this. So that's the other deal, is that I had a latitude in my job, so I could do this kind of thing. So I started going there. And, geez, I don't know how many years it took me. I don't know how many doors got shut on me. I don't know how many legislators I followed into the bathroom. Only the male legislators, you guys. But I would hang out, actually, outside the women's room. Jim knows about this, don't you, Jim? Because women have to go to the bathroom too, and the legislators are always running. And if you can talk to them when they're in between appointments, they're kind of off guard. And if you chat them up in the right way, they'll pay attention to you, and you get more accomplished that actually when you're sitting down. Isn't that right, Jim? So I was able to do it. I did it. But I only did it because of the pain that I felt, the anger that I felt, and that I was able then to be in stillness with my Zaza, and then in the day go and do it. And then I didn't give up. But you know, if you really want something deeply, you don't give up. You just don't give up. And it partly depends on your wound, on the nature of your wound, I think. So the most important part of treating difficulty as opportunity is persistence. Robert Pirsig, one of the founders of Zen Center, wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and that's why we're here, because he gave us money. I talked about this a few talks ago. He sent his manuscript to 20 publishers, and they all turned him down. Then he sent it to another 20, and they all turned him down. Then he sent it to another 20, and all turn them down. It wasn't until he'd sent it to 100 publishers that he got it published. That's persistence, huh? And he began working on a second book while he was doing this. He was so persistent. Leela, which I've never read. Leela or Lila? Leela, I guess, huh? John Grisham. How many of you guys know John Grisham? Well, most of you know John Grisham. So I don't read novels much, but when I'm on vacation, I like to try to find a good John Grisham novel. John Grisham, you know, legal thrillers. So he has three suggestions for persistence, which apply, I think, universally. First, he says, persistence is habit forming. Persistence in anything helps us persist in everything. Persistence in anything helps us persist in everything. He went to law school, and then he persevered for years of study. He passed the bar, and he just persisted to write. Began to write and persisted to write. Second, he says, persistence is a product of passion and interest combined. Passion and interest combined. He aced law school because he loved learning about the law. But he ran screaming from his day job as a lawyer because the work of an attorney bore little resemblance to the great debates he'd had in law school and the great debates he was fantasizing about for his novels. So he just stayed with it. He just stayed with it. Because he had the passion and he had the interest. Third, persistence happens a moment at a time. Good Zen teaching, huh? A moment at a time. He had a demanding job. He had a young family. He had to get up at 5:30 if he was going to write. Sounds quite familiar to me. had to get up at 5:30. And then he had to measure his progress in sentences. In sentences. He started out with chapters, and he couldn't get anywhere. Then he went to pages, but some days he couldn't do a page. So then he got it down to sentences and words. And every day he could do at least 3 or 4 sentences. So a totality of a big task, whatever it is, it can overwhelm us. But if we break it down into its little bite-sized pieces, then we move little by little toward our goal. Turtle practice. Turtle practice. And John Grisham's fourth thing he learned. Persistent people don't care what you think about them. Persistent people don't care what you think about them. Grisham kept a file of all those rejection letters as a reminder of all the people who thought his stuff was just bad, would go nowhere, was a waste of time. This is important. When you really care about something, when you really want something that is in your heart of hearts, don't worry about what other people think. Don't worry. You'll give up right away. I would have given up my Zen practice right away. So, speaking of my Zen practice, I think this may be in my book, but I'm not my first book, but I'm not sure. I've talked about it over the years. I was having a really difficult time in my Zen practice, and sometime in my early 20s, I've been practicing 2 or 3 years, and I was feeling what was difficult to impossible, especially to sit still, and especially to sit still for a whole day. I could sit still for 40 minutes, kind of, but then as I got more experience at concentrating, was able to concentrate well, it was actually harder for me to sit still. My body actually started shaking, and I had trouble with tremors. And I remember being at work and the person saying, oh, you have tremors in your hands. Is that a product of your meditation? And I thought, God, is that a product of my meditation? I said, no. But I was totally confused. And, of course, I went to my teacher, and he said, oh, go to Katagiri, as the founding teacher here. He said he has some exercises. So I went to Katagiri, and he gave me some exercises to do. It didn't help. Anyway, so my physical, I still don't understand this intellectually, but luckily I don't have to understand it. Although when people come to me with that problem, the problem of shaking, I try to remember what happened to me. But what happened to me is that I just didn't quit. And there were two really tall guys in the Zendo who were in charge of the Zendo. For those of you who don't know, this is a Zendo, right? Who wanted me to sit just outside the Zendo because of my shaking. They said, here, you can sit outside here. And one of them was named Graham, and the other was named Dick, and they were really tall. And I'm saying that they were really tall because I'm only 5'6", at least I used to be 5'6". I may be shorter now, but I don't want to measure it, right? I'm maybe down to 5'5½" or 5'5", but let's not talk about it. Because I'm a guy, and in this culture, it's hard for guys, especially as they're kids, to be small. To be short. We feel inferior, believe it or not. We like to play basketball. I love to play basketball, but there'd always be some tall guy who'd be slapping me down. but I was persistent. I played every day, but I got slapped down every day. We like to hang out with girls, but we've got to find girls as short as us to hang out with. There aren't that many. So these tall guys and me. So then I had this dream. And in the dream, and I was getting ready to quit Zen Center at the time, to quit Zen meditation. And in the dream, it's a short dream, I was in the Zendo, and Graham and Dick were so tall that their heads were going up to the ceiling. They were like Alice. You know, Alice in Wonderland, she grew so tall. Their heads were up to the ceiling. And Suzuki Roshi, my teacher, was there, and he was just tiny, and he was doing somersaults around their legs. And he was beckoning me to come into the Zendo to do somersaults with him around their legs. And he was even shorter than me. And then I woke up, and I decided not to quit. I felt a huge relief when I woke up. I thought, oh, this is possible, even for me. It's possible, even for me. Everything is possible. Everything is possible. Now, the end goal that we get, that we wanted, it may change along the way, but that's okay. Just persistence. Just persistence. And sometimes, in the midst of failure, what we don't want to be told is everything is going to be okay. We don't want to be told that. So that's not helpful. That's not helpful. My roommate kept telling me everything is going to be okay, and he said perfectly. So how dare he tell me everything is going to be okay when he could sit in full lotus for a day, and I could barely sit for 10 minutes. So we don't want to be told that, right? Don't do that. Don't tell someone. But if we stick, if we persist in something we really care about, we deeply care about, even if we don't get our goal, and we might, some things happen. Three things happen. One, our empathy increases out of the pain and humiliation of our failure. A wellspring of compassion can come up. Our sadness can scoop out a place in here, in our heart, where love can reside. It can scoop it out. So with me, because of this, my brother's suicide and this, all this anger I felt, and then the sadness, I was able to really begin to identify people with chemical problems, even though I never had one myself. Identify people with all kinds of mental health problems and really feel their pain. So empathy can increase when we just keep with what we want to deeply do. And another thing that happens is there's an increase in humility, right? That's natural. You're going to fall down. You're going to feel humble. You're going to surrender the notion that you deserve something better. You don't deserve anything better. This is what is. You deserve what is. We all deserve what is. Of course, you don't deserve anything worse either. So be careful of this kind of religious humility, which is so extreme that we cripple ourselves because we say, I'm not good enough. You're good enough. You're good enough because you are. Just because you are. The third thing that can happen is that our resilience can increase. Our resilience can increase. So my friend Tom had his second divorce when he was about 40, and he said to me, I'll never let myself be vulnerable to rejection again. But then he began to soften up a little and realize how important love and companionship was to him. So he began to change what he was saying. Instead of saying, I'm never going to get hurt again, it's too scary out there, he began to open up his heart on purpose. So this is our practice, you guys. This is our practice as human beings, to go beyond our crust. Go beyond our crust. Our crust just shrivels us away, so the older we get, the more shriveled we get, instead of the more open and spacious. And if we have too much success, if we don't have any failure, then what happens? We get arrogant, we get insensitive, we get shallow. I have a friend in California whose ex-husband is a famous brain surgeon in Palo Alto, my hometown in California. And she said, I was talking to her a while ago, and she said, you know, he is so arrogant. Her ex-husband, right? He is so arrogant. He is so insensitive. He's so shallow. He gets treated like he's a special person by everybody. And so he doesn't know what it is to really fail and open up and feel connected. He's just in la-la land. And she said, and all of his friends who are brain surgeons are like that too. Well, I don't know if that's true. But that's her take on it. The fact is that failure is part of life, and we can learn a lot from it and open up our hearts really huge because of it. Usually when we fail, we fight, flight, or freeze, right? It's fight, flight, or freeze. Avoiding our emotions, harshly judging ourselves, rehashing the past, fully anticipating, fearfully anticipating what's the next bad thing that's going to happen to us. We better go even more into our shell. Or maybe acting impulsively on the other end of the spectrum. Instead, let's think about what we really care about and who we want to be. Let's organize our behavior around our core values. So I want to end by giving... six hints to dealing with difficulty and failure. First, this is just so typical Zen, but I probably shouldn't even say it, but engage wholeheartedly in each activity. If you engage wholeheartedly, you're not judging yourself as you're engaging. There's no room for judgment because you're totally engaging. So you're not being, your critical mind is in abeyance when you totally engage yourself. You know that, don't you? It doesn't matter whether it's zazen or washing the dishes. Engage in your activity wholeheartedly. And in your zazen, in your meditation, if some strong emotion comes in, and a strong emotion doesn't have to come in. Somebody said to me recently, oh, you talk about emotion, but I don't have emotions while I'm sitting. I think there's something wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with you. Good, lucky for you. You don't have to have emotion. Everybody thinks their zazen should be a certain way. But if zazen does, if a strong emotion does come in, as it did with me, and that circumstance over and over and over again, day after day, week after week, month after month, if it does, then open up to it. Be with it. Be with it. And notice it in your body. Notice the sensations. Notice where you're feeling tightness or constriction or warmth or heat. And just be with it, with an open heart. Just be with it. Sometimes it moves, sometimes it changes, sometimes it just stays where it is. Maybe in your shoulder blades, maybe around your heart. Just be with it. And then the sensations do change. As the sensations change, the emotion loosens up. It loosens up. So washing the sensations is a great way of letting go of emotional fixation. Because sensations are always changing. Hint number two. When negative emotions come up, endorse them. Endorse your anger. Endorse your sadness. I'm not saying indulge it. I'm saying endorse it. Without feeling guilty or ashamed or self-punishing or getting pissed at the universe. Endorse it. Let it. There it is. It's alive. It has energy. It's not bad. And it's about my suffering. It's about my suffering. We suffer as human beings, but our suffering is our opportunity. Our opportunity. Now, hit number three, don't globalize. Oh, I failed at my zazen day after day. I'm just no good. I'm no good. I failed at my 32 dates with this different women. I'm no good. I'm no good. Don't globalize. Both fear and failure are impermanent. Isn't that what Buddhism says? That everything's impermanent? Well, so don't globalize. Don't do all or never thinking. Or notice it. Notice when you're doing all or never thinking. You're shutting down. You're closing into your little scared self. It's not a reflection of your essence. Your essence is stillness and openness. You contain multitudes. It's not a reflection on your self-worth. Maybe you fail, but you're not a failure. Maybe you failed again, but you're not a failure. Maybe you failed again, but you're not a failure. Turtle practice. There's always a risk when we pursue opportunities and adventures as opposed to freezing in place. Now, I'm not too fond of Amazon. I'm especially not too fond of the fact that they've just taken over Whole Foods and they're going to take over the universe shortly. But something Jeff Bezos said is very cool. He says, in his annual letters to shareholders, Every one of his annual letters has contained the words invent and fail. And here's what he says. Failure comes part and parcel with invention. It's not optional. We understand that and believe in failing early and iterating it until we get it right. That means failing over and over again until we get it right. Fourth tip. Don't be judgmental when you fail and put yourself down. I shouldn't be angry after 2 years of sitting here on the Zafu. I was here every morning for 2 years. I'm still feeling angry? I shouldn't be doing that, right? I'm a Zen priest. I'm teaching Zen. I shouldn't be that, right? That should is so punitive. So punitive. It knows how things should be. Does it really know how things to be? That's your internal parent. That's something that happened when you were a kid, telling you, you've got to be this way. So you can see that. But you don't need to believe it, do you? Instead, increase your positive statements when the task looks too hard. And if you say to yourself, if I persist, I can do this, whatever it is. Okay, maybe I made a mistake, but I'm trying and I can be proud of myself. Say these things to yourself. That's good. In Japanese Zen monasteries, I don't know if it's still like that, but both Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi used to say, when you're in the monastery and you're walking in the halls and you pass the teacher and the teacher gives you some instruction on something, you say, hi. That means yes. You immediately say, hi, yes. So regardless of what the difficulty is, you're going to do it, hi. And it's just part of the protocol. The point here is that if you're, I mean, that sounds kind of maybe militaristic, but if you're encouraged just to say yes and just to try, just to keep persisting, that after a while you're saying hi to yourself. Yes, I'll do this. Yes, I'll do this. The fifth one, get encouragement from others. So you can cross the threshold of your painful emotions again and again until you're flowing with them. Catholic mystic Henry Nouwen said, the friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair, who can tolerate not knowing, who can tolerate us not healing, and face the reality of our powerlessness is the friend who cares. Ironically, the friend who can tolerate not knowing is also the friend who knows, says Henry. He understands and accepts the chaos and uncertainty of life. The last tip, see through your shame. See through your shame. We fear failure because we associate it with bad things that happened to us in our childhood. Well, now I'm being a psychologist, but I can't help it, you know. I am a psychologist. So. Bad things happened to us. Big people scared us. They did things to us. And you can't, that just happens in life. But if we associate failure with shame, then we get crippled. So see through our shame. It comes from something that happened to us a long time ago, the shame. And instead of hunkering down, share your failures instead of hiding them. Share them. It works. It works because, you know, not only you have the failure, then you've got to tell people about it. I don't want to tell anybody, but if you share it, what happens? Why do 12-step groups work? Why do they work at all? Isn't that the key? One of the real keys? Share your failures. Don't keep them a secret. And you become risk averse. We stay fearful. If we share them, we disempower them. So supposedly Dogen said, a Zen master's life is one mistake after another. Whew. Good. What a relief. So one last story. So when I was practicing with my teacher, I had a big enlightenment experience. And then I thought everything was going to be different. It seemed like everything was different. But I started noticing all the times that I was screwing things up and that I was letting people down and that I was not available. And I went to my teacher and I said to him, "What's the deal here?" I didn't exactly say that. I don't know. I was respectful. But I thought to myself, "What's the deal here? I have this enlightenment experience and things seem harder than ever. What's the deal here?" So I went to my teacher and I said, "You know, and you even said I had attained so-called," he did tell me I had attained so-called enlightenment. Well, of course he said so-called. I'm making more mistakes than ever. And he said, "Oh, I know exactly what you mean. It's like that for me, too." That was the end of the conversation. So I think I'll end on that note. And so thank you. And we have about 5 minutes if anybody has any comments or questions. Yeah.
Pema Chodron had a good story about getting over identifying with failure. She was talking about being at a retreat where there was work practice, and she found that she was physically unable to do any of the work that they asked her to do. And she felt useless, and other people were a little frustrated with her. And then she went to give a talk, and all these people came to see her, and they treated her special, and they, so it was this big difference between how she was treated in one situation or how she felt about herself.
Yeah.
And she found it much easier to see that neither one is the definition of who she is.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, she is vast. She contains multitudes. Thank you. Good example. Yeah, Charlie.
I was going to say, you're just the right height. Any taller, you'd be banging
your head. Oh! Oh! Okay. Oh, all right.
When you said these were really tall guys, did anybody other than me glance over at Peter?
Did anybody what?
Sorry. When you kind of the two guys that you knew with Zendo were really tall guys?
Yeah.
I just said, did anybody else glance over at Peter?
At Peter? Oh. Well, I don't think actually they were as tall as Peter. But they seemed taller to me.
He said Suzuki. Did you know the author D.T. Suzuki?
Did I know D.T. Suzuki? No.
Okay, different guy.
Yeah, my Suzuki. Oh, my Suzuki. My Suzuki. is Shinryu Suzuki, the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And when we were going to the Zen monastery that we opened in Tassajara, the first Zen monastery in the country, D.T. Suzuki was on the East Coast, and my teacher was on the West Coast. D.T. Suzuki was very old, and I think he may have died, I think just a few months before we opened it. And Suzuki was riding down with me in the car, and he said to me, D.T. Suzuki will be there too. That's all he said.
I remember the guest roshi we had from the southeastern corner a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
Said that D.T. Suzuki was one of the first authors that brought him to Buddhism.
Yes, he's very early. He wrote in the 50s. Earliest books were the early 1950s, I think. Maybe even the late 40s, yes. Yeah.
Thank you for your time today and your thoughts. Will any of the quotes from the individuals that you
said
today be on the website or available?
Any of the quotes from the individuals? Well, my talk is, they put my talk online, but okay, unless somebody wants to, wants to transcribe all this stuff and write it down.
One thing I found interesting enough, you can hear recordings and they're not real clear. Katagiri speaking here. I believe, again, having listened to a little bit of them, I believe they're recorded on cassette.
Yes.
It's a little hard to understand, but yeah, there's on the website you can hear about.
And also, Andrea Martin has a new book coming out of Katagiri Roshi's teaching. Which will be out and around in the fall. And it's a beautiful book. And and that's his, the fourth book? The fourth book. Yeah, so these, my two teachers, there are lots of books. But Suzuki's got three books, I think. You know, so it's seven books. Is that right? Seven or eight books. So it's all there. It's all there for the taking, but not grabbing, just using it to inspire yourself so you can open your heart.
I guess the website, the recordings of Katagiri were done on cassette in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, that's right. Andrea knows all about that. She's listened to 82,000 of them.
Some efforts have been made to clean them up, but it's pretty hard to do.
One more? Yeah.
Yes. Some parts of your talk where I was connecting with an interview I heard with a comedian about how he honestly shares struggles in his life and that fuels his comedy routines. I was wondering if you see in those seven tips where maybe where humor fits well.
Oh, well, humor. Could you guys hear him? Oh. Well, I'll try paraphrasing you. So he's talking about how comedians share their failures and how we like that. And then what was the second part? I'm sorry.
The tips you shared, where you think humor fits.
Oh, he wants to know where humor fits in the tips I was sharing. Well, humor is just key to all of this, because humor means we can fall actually gracefully. You can fall gracefully if you can laugh at yourself, and you hurt yourself some, but you see the humor in it. There's just everything in life is up and down, everything is rising and falling, and you can laugh at yourself and laugh at everybody, and that really is an outgrowth of meditation practice, the ability just to laugh. Everything that's tragic has its comic side.
This is why brain surgeons are arrogant. They never fail, because when they fail, they become taxicab drivers. They're no longer brain surgeons. And so, of course, only the arrogant ones are left.
They also are seriously injuring their patients.
Exactly.
They take that failure and they hold on to it, and they often don't tell anyone.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thanks a lot, and turn it over to Carrie.